Side 2, Storm of the Century by Stephen King, continuing on page 34.
Davy.
Mrs. Clarendon. Someone killed Mrs. Clarendon. There's blood all over. One of her eyes is out. It's on her cheek. Oh, God, one of her eyeballs is right out on her cheek.
People are coming to windows and opening front doors to look. They all know Davy, of course. But before anyone can grab him and calm him down, a big green Lincoln pulls in front of him, like a cop cutting off a speeder. Written on the side is Island Atlantic Realty. A portly gentleman in a suit, tie, and topcoat, the only business garb on Little Tall Island, quite likely, gets out. We may or may not see a resemblance to the absurd mannequin on the store's porch. This is Robbie Beals. The local big deal, the unpleasant Don Beals' even more unpleasant father. Now he grabs Davy by the shoulders of his jacket and gives him a hard shake. Robbie.
Davy, stop it. Stop that right now.
Davy stops it and begins to get himself under control. Robbie.
Why are you running down the middle of Atlantic Street making a spectacle of yourself?
Davy.
Someone killed Mrs. Clarendon.
Robbie.
Nonsense. What are you talking about?
Davy.
There's blood everywhere. And her eyes out. It's on her cheek.
Davy begins to weep. Other people are gathering now, looking at the man and the boy. Slowly, Robbie releases Davy. Something is going on here. Something that may be serious, and if so, there's only one man to check it out. We see this realization dawning on Robbie's face. He looks around at a middle-aged woman with a sweater hastily pulled around her shoulders and a bowl of cake batter still in one hand. Robbie.
Mrs. Kingsbury, look after him. Get him a hot tea.
Reconsiders.
No, give him a little whiskey, if you've got some.
Mrs. Kingsbury.
Are you going to call Mike Anderson?
Robbie looks sour. There's no love loss between him and Mike. Robbie.
Not until I take a look for myself.
Davy.
Be careful, Mr. Beals. She's dead, but there's someone in the house, I think.
Robbie looks at him impatiently. The boy is clearly hysterical. An old man with a craggy New England face steps forward. George Kirby.
You want help, Robbie Beals?
Robbie.
Not necessary, George. I'll be fine.
He gets back into his car. It's too big to U-turn in the street, so he uses a neighboring driveway. Davy.
He shouldn't go up there alone.
The group in the street, which is still growing, watches Robbie drive up to Mrs. Clarendon's with troubled eyes. Mrs. Kingsbury.
Come on inside, Davy. I'm not giving whiskey to a child, but I can put the teapot on.
She puts an arm around him and leads him toward the house. 46. Exterior, Martha Clarendon's house. Robbie's Lincoln pulls up in front. He gets out, surveys the path, the overturned walker, the open door. His face suggests that this might be a little more serious than he at first thought. But he starts up the path anyway. Leave it to that know-all Mike Anderson? Not likely. 47. Exterior, Little Tall Island Town Hall. Day. This is a white wooden building, stark in the New England style, and the center of the town's public life. In front of it is a little cupola with a largish bell inside, a bell the size of an apple basket, say. The Island Services four-wheel drive pulls up in front, using a slot marked reserved for town business. 48. Interior. The Island Services vehicle with Mike and Hatch. Hatch has got a pamphlet called Storm Preparedness, State of Maine Guidelines. He's deep in it. Mike, you want to come in? Hatch doesn't look up.
Nope, I'm fine.
As Mike opens the door, Hatch does look up and gives Mike a sweet, open smile. Hatch,
thanks for seeing after my little girl, boss.
Mike smiles back.
My pleasure.
49. Exterior. Angle on the Island Services four-wheel drive. Mike gets out, once more settling his hat so it won't blow off,
As he does this, he takes another small measuring glance at the sky. 50. Exterior. Mike, on the walk. He stops at the cupola. Now that we're closer, we can read the plaque in front. There is a list of war dead on it. 10 from the Civil War, 1 from the Spanish-American, a couple each from Juan, Tu, and Korea, and 6 from Vietnam, the Po-Folks War. Among the names we see, lots of Beelses, Godsoes, Hatchers, and Robichauds. Above the list, in big letters, is this: when we ring for the living, we honor our dead. Mike brushes the bell's clapper with a gloved forefinger. It rings faintly, then he goes on inside. 51. Interior. The little tall island town office. It's your usual cluttered secretarial bullpen, dominated by an aerial photo of the island on one wall. A single woman is running the whole show. Plump and pretty Ursula Godso. She has a plaque with her name on it beside the in-out basket on her desk. Behind her, through a number of glass windows along the main corridor, we see the actual town meeting hall. This consists of many straight-backed benches, like Puritan pews, and a bare wood lectern with a microphone. Looks more like church than government. Nobody's out there right now. Prominent on the wall of Ursula's office is the same sign we saw on the door of the market. Storm emergency possible next 3 days. Take shelter. Signal is 2 shorts, 1 long. Mike strolls over and looks at this, waiting for Ursula. She is on the phone, speaking to someone in tones of forced patience. Ursula.
No, Betty. I haven't heard any more than you have. We're all dealing with the same forecast. No, not the memorial bell, not with the winds we're expecting. It'll be the siren comes to that. 2 shorts and 1 long. That's right. Mike Anderson, of course. Those are decisions we pay him to make, aren't they, dear?
Ursula winks broadly at Mike and gives him a one-moment gesture. Mike raises his own hand and claps his fingers against his thumb several times, miming a talking mouth. Ursula grins and nods. Ursula.
Yes, I'll be praying, too. Of course, we all will. Thanks for calling, Daddy.
She hangs up and closes her eyes for a moment. Mike. Tough day? Ursula.
Betty Soames seems to think we have access to some secret forecast.
Mike. Kind of a Gene Dixon forecast? Psychic weather? Ursula.
I guess.
Mike taps the storm emergency placard. Mike. Most people in town have seen this. Ursula.
If they're not blind, they've seen it. You need to relax, Mike Anderson. How's little Pippa Hatcher?
Mike, whoa, that was fast. Ursula,
yeah, no secrets on the island.
Mike, she's fine. Got her head stuck in the stairs. Her dad's out in the car doing his homework for the big blow of 89. Ursula, laughing.
Ain't that just like Alton and Melinda Hatcher's daughter? Perfect.
Grows serious.
People know this one's bad, and if they hear the siren, they'll come. You needn't worry about that. Now, you came to look at the emergency shelter setup, didn't you?
Mike, thought it might not be a bad idea. Ursula, gets up.
We can handle 300 for 3 days, 150 for a week. And if what I'm hearing on the radio is right, we may have to. Come on, let's look.
They start out of the room, Ursula leading. 52. Interior. Robbie Beals, close up. His face is horrified, unbelieving. Robbie.
Oh, my God!
Weather lady, voiceover.
Saw enough doom and gloom already. Let's talk sunshine.
The camera pulls back, and we see he is kneeling beside Martha in her hall, performing the useless ritual of trying to take her pulse. We can see her wrist and the blood-stained cuff of her dress, but that's all. Robbie looks around, unbelieving. In the background, the weather lady is spieling on. Linoge broke the TV, but she's there, just the same. Weather lady, voiceover.
The finest weather in the U.S. today? Well, there's no question about that. The big island of Hawaii. Temperatures in the high 70s to low 80s, plus an onshore breeze to cool things off. And things ain't too shabby in Florida, either. Last week's chill there is a thing of the past. In Miami, temperatures are in the mid-70s, and how about Sanibel Island and beautiful Captiva? If you're down that way, you'll be picking up shells with plenty of sunshine to show you the way, and temps in the high 80s.
Robbie.
Is anybody here?
He gets to his feet. He looks first at the walls, where some of Martha's nice old pictures are now dotted with a fine spray of blood. Then he looks at the floor and sees more blood, the thin line drawn by Linoja's cane and those big, dark smacks that were left by Davy's bouncing ball.
Robbie.
Is anybody here?
He pauses, undecided, then starts down the hall. 53. Black. A bank of overhead fluorescence snaps on, revealing the spacious basement room of the town hall. This room is ordinarily used for dances, bingo, and various town functions. Signs on the pine-paneled walls remind visitors of the volunteer fire department blood drive, which will be held right here. Now the room is filled with cots, each with a small pillow at its head and a folded blanket at its foot. At the far end are stacks of coolers, cartons of bottled water, and a big radio with its digital readout flashing. Ursula and Mike stand looking at this. Ursula.
Good?
Mike. You know it is. She smiles. How's the supply closet? Ursula.
Full, just like you wanted. Concentrates mostly. Pour the water over the powder and then gag it down, but nobody'll starve.
Mike. You did all this yourself?
Ursula. Me and Pete's sister, Tavia. Be discreet, you said. Don't panic anyone.
Mike. Yeah, that's what I said. How many people know we're stocked for World War III?
Ursula. Perfectly serene. Everyone.
Mike winces, but doesn't look too surprised. Mike.
No secrets on the island.
Ursula. A bit defensive.
I didn't talk Mike Anderson, and neither did Tavia. Mostly it was Robbie Beals who spread the tattle. Madder than a wet hen about all this he is. Claims you're costing the town money for no reason.
Mike. Well, we'll see.
Pause.
Tell you one thing. His kid makes a hell of a good monkey.
Ursula. What?
Mike. Never mind.
Ursula. Want to look in the storage?
Mike. I think I'll trust you. Let's go back up. She reaches for the switch, then pauses. Her face is troubled.
Ursula. How serious is this, Mike?
Mike. I don't know. I hope Robbie Beals can kick my ass for being an alarmist come town meeting next month. Come on, let's go.
Ursula flicks the switch and the room goes black. 54. Interior. Martha Clarendon's living room. We're looking toward the hall door. The TV is louder. It's an ad for a litigation law firm. Have you been injured in an accident? Can't work? Lost your mind?
TV announcer. Voiceover.
You feel hopeless. You may even feel that the whole world is against you, but the firm of McIntosh and Redding will stand with you and see that you get your day in court. Don't make a bad situation worse. When life hands you a bag of lemons, we can help you make lemonade. Stick it to them before they can stick it to you. If you have been injured in an accident, you may have thousands, even tens of thousands of dollars waiting for you. So don't wait. Call now. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-1-STICK-EM. That's 1-800.
Robbie comes into the doorway. His arrogance and authority have gone. He looks rumpled, nauseated, and scared to death. 55. Interior. The living room, from Robbie's point of view. The TV is smashed to hell, smoking, but still the TV ad blares on.
TV announcer, voiceover, continues. 1-STICK-EM. Get what's coming to you. Haven't you been through enough?
We can see the top of Linoja's head over the back of the chair. There is a slurp as he sips tea. 56. Interior, the living room, a wider angle.
We're mostly over Robbie's shoulder here, looking at the smashed but still talking TV and the top of Linoja's head. Robbie.
Who are you?
The TV falls silent. Outside, we hear the wind of the rising storm. Slowly, slowly, the snarling silver wolf rises above the back of the chair, pointed at Robbie like a sinister puppet. Its eyes and muzzle seem to drip blood. It wags slowly back and forth like a pendulum. Manoj, voice.
Born in sin, come on in.
Robbie flinches, opens his mouth, then closes it again. What do you say to a remark like that? But Manoj isn't finished. Manoj, voice.
You were with a whore in Boston when your mother died in Machias. Ma was in that crappy nursing home they closed down last fall. The one where they found the rats in the pantry, right? She choked to death calling your name. Isn't that sweet? Other than a good slice of processed yellow cheese, there's nothing on earth like a mother's love.
57. Interior. Robbie. Big reaction here. How would any of us react if told one of our darkest secrets by a murderous stranger we could not properly see? Linoj. Voice.
But that's all right, Robbie.
Another big reaction from Robbie. The stranger knows his name. 58. Interior. Martha's chair. Linoj peeks around the chair's left side wing, almost coyly. His eyes are more or less normal, but he is almost as blood-streaked as the head of his silver bludgeon.
Linoj. She's waiting for you in hell, and she's turned cannibal. When you get there, she's going to eat you alive, over and over and over again, because that's what hell's about, repetition. I think in our hearts, most of us know that. Catch.
He heaves Davy's basketball. 59. Interior. The living room doorway with Robbie. The ball hits him in the chest, leaving a blood mark. Robbie's had enough. He turns and flees, screaming. 60. Interior. Martha's living room, angle on chair and TV. Once again, we can see the top of Linoja's head. Then his hand appears, rolled into a fist. It hovers in the air for a moment, then one finger pops out, pointed at the TV. The weather lady resumes immediately. Weather lady, voiceover.
Let's check the area apt to be most severely affected by the oncoming storm.
Linoj reaches for another cookie. 61. Exterior, in front of Martha's. Robbie bolts down the steps to his car, as fast as his chubby little legs will carry him. His face is a mask of horror and bewilderment. 62. Interior, Martha's living room, featuring the TV. The camera moves in slowly on the shattered picture tube and smoking innards as the weather lady talks. Weather lady, voiceover.
The forecast calls for destruction tonight. Death tomorrow and Armageddon by the weekend. In fact, this could be the end of life as we know it.
63. Interior. Linoj.
Linoj. Seems unlikely, but we can always hope.
He takes another bite of cookie. Fade out. This ends Act 2. Act 3. 64. Exterior. Robbie's Lincoln, with Robbie, Day. He claws at the driver's side door. Down the street, a number of townsfolk are watching him curiously. George Kirby.
Everything all right up there, Beals?
Robbie doesn't answer the old guy. He gets his car door open and dives inside. He has a CB radio under the dash, and now he yanks the mic off its prong. He punches the power button, punches in channel 19, and speaks. All during this, he keeps casting panicky glances at the open door of the Clarendon house, in terror that Martha's killer will show up. Robbie.
This is Robbie Beals for Constable Anderson. Come back, Anderson. This is an emergency.
65. Interior. Anderson's Market. Day. The market is as crowded as ever. Cat and Tess Marchant, a motherly-looking woman in her mid to late 40s, have been checking folks out just as fast as they can, but now everyone freezes as the radio spews out its excited babble.
Robbie, voice.
Come back, damn it, Anderson. We've got a murder over here. Martha Clarendon's been beaten to death.
A dismayed, disbelieving murmur goes through the shoppers at that. Their eyes get big. Robbie, voice.
The guy who did it is still in the house, Anderson. Anderson? You come back, do you hear me? You're always around when it comes to unwanted advice. Where are you when...
Tess Marchant takes the microphone from the radio like a woman in a dream. Tess.
Robbie, this is Tess Marchant. Mike's not...
Robbie, voice.
I don't want you. I want Anderson. I can't do his job and mine, too.
Cat takes the mic.
He had an emergency at home. Alton went with him. It was his little
Just then, Mike and Hatch come in through the door. Cat and Tess look incredibly relieved. A low murmur runs through the crowd. Mike makes about 3 steps into the room, then stops, realizing something very much out of the ordinary is going on here. Mike.
What?
What is it? Nobody in the market will answer him. Meantime, the radio continues to squawk. Robbie, voice.
What do you mean, an emergency at home? There's an emergency right here. An old woman murdered, a lunatic, in Martha Clarendon's living room. I want the town constable.
Mike walks quickly to the counter. Cat gives him the mic as if glad to be rid of it. Mike, what's he talking about? Who's murdered? Tess.
Martha, he says.
Another louder murmur this time. Mike pushes transmit button. I'm here, Robbie. Just a minute. Robbie, voice.
Never mind just a minute, damn it. I could be in a life-threatening situation here.
Mike ignores the man for the moment, holding the mic against his chest and talking to the 2 dozen or so islanders who have clumped together at the heads of the aisles, staring at him stunned. There hasn't been a murder on this island for almost 70 years, unless you count Dolores Claiborne's husband, Joe, and that was never proved. Mike, you folks back off now and give me a little privacy. I get $6,000 a year to be constable. Let me do the job you pay me for. They back off, but are still listening. How can they help it? Mike, meanwhile, turns so his back is to them and he's facing the radio and the lottery ticket dispensers. Mike, where are you, Robbie? Come back. 66. Interior. Robbie in his car. Behind him, we can see townspeople, probably a dozen of them, standing in the street and watching. They have worked themselves quite a bit closer, but don't dare come all the way. The door to Martha's house still stands ominously open. Robbie.
Martha Clarendon's house on Atlantic Street. Where did you think I was, Bar Harbor? I'm...
A great idea occurs to him.
I'm keeping the man inside at bay. Now, get your ass down here.
He racks the mic, then fumbles in the glove compartment. Under the jumble of maps, town documents, and whopper wrappers, he finds a little pistol. He gets out of his car. 67. Exterior. Robbie. Robbie calls down to the cluster of folks.
You stay where you are.
With his authority thus exerted, Robbie turns toward the house and points his gun at the open door. He has recovered a certain amount of his toad-like savoir-faire, but he's not about to go back in there. The man in there didn't just kill Martha Clarendon. He knew where Robbie was when Robbie's mother died. He knew Robbie's name. The wind gusts, blowing Robbie's gray-streaked hair back from his brow, and the first few snowflakes of the storm of the century go dancing past his face. 68. Interior. Anderson's Market. With Mike, Hatch, onlookers. Mike stands with the microphone in his hand, trying to think what to do next. As Cat Withers takes the mic and racks it, he makes up his mind. Mike, to Hatch. Let's take another ride, all right? Hatch.
Sure.
Mike. Cat, you and Tess are minding the store. Raising his voice.
All you folks just stay and finish your shopping, all right? There's nothing you can do on Atlantic Street, and whatever's happened over there, you'll know it soon enough.
As he speaks, he moves behind the cash register. He reaches beneath it. 69. Interior. The shelf. Close-up. On it are a .38 and a pair of handcuffs. Mike takes both. 70. Interior. Angle on Mike. He puts the handcuffs in one coat pocket and the .38 in the other. This is done quickly and deftly. None of the goggle-eyed customers see. Cat and Tess do, though, and it brings the reality of the situation home to them. Crazy as it may be, there could be a dangerous criminal on Little Tall. Cat.
Do you want me to call your wives?
Mike. Absolutely not. Then he looks at the avidly watching islanders. If Cat doesn't, one of them will, as soon as he or she can reach the nearest phone. Mike. Yeah, I guess you better. But make sure they know the situation is under control. 71. Exterior. Anderson's Market. Mike and Hatch hurry down the steps, and the camera tracks them to the island services utility vehicle. The snow is still just flurrying, but we can see that it's thicker now. Hatch.
Snows early.
Mike stops with one hand on the driver's side door handle. He takes a deep breath, preparing himself, then lets it out. Mike. Yeah, it is. Let's go. They get in and drive away. Meantime, people have been drifting out onto the porch watching them. 72. Exterior. The Robbie Beals mannequin. The propeller on the beanie is now turning briskly. 73. Exterior. The town dock. The waves crash high against the pilings, throwing spray. The work of securing the boats and getting loose gear under cover has progressed quite a bit. We focus in on George Kirby, an older guy, 60-ish, Alex Haber, 35, and Cal Fries, a 20-something. Alex points west toward the end of the docks and the reach beyond. Alex Haber.
Look at there, at the mainland.
74. Exterior. Mainland, from the dock's point of view. The mainland is about 2 miles away and quite clear. Gray-green woods, mostly. 75. Exterior. Resume dock with Sonny, Alex, and Cal. Alex Haber.
When you can't see over there no more, it's time to get in while you can. And when you can't even see the reach no more, it's time to head down to the town hall, whether you've heard the siren or not.
Cal Fries to George.
How bad do you think it'll be, Unc?
George Kirby.
Maybe the worst we ever saw. Come on, help me with the last of these nets.
Pause.
I wonder if that fool Beals has any slight idea what he's doing up there.
76. Exterior. Atlantic Street, in front of Martha's house. The fool Beals is still being the good sentry, standing in front of his Lincoln with his .38 pointed at the open door of the Clarendon house. Snow is coming down more thickly now. It's scattered across the shoulders of his topcoat like dandruff. He's been here for a while. Down below, a little gathering of watchers. Mrs. Kingsbury and Davy Hopewell are back among them, moves aside to allow the island services vehicle through. It pulls up beside the Lincoln. Mike gets out from behind the wheel, Hatch from the passenger seat. Hatch.
You want the shotgun?
Mike.
I guess we better have it.
You just make sure the safety's on, Alton Hatcher. Hatch leans back into the truck, fumbles, and reappears with the shotgun that is ordinarily kept latched under the dash. Hatch ostentatiously checks the safety, and then they approach Robbie. Robbie's attitude toward Mike all through this is one of confrontation and contempt. The history of these feelings will never be fully explored, but its basis is undoubtedly Robbie's desire to keep all the reins of power in his own hands. Robbie.
It's about time.
Mike. Put that thing away, Robbie. Robbie.
No such thing, Constable Anderson. You do your job, I'll do mine.
Mike. Your job is real estate. Would you at least lower it, please? Pause.
Come on, Robbie. It's in my face, and I know it's loaded.
Robbie grudgingly lowers the .38. Hatch, meanwhile, is looking nervously at the open door and the overturned walker. Mike.
What happened?
Robbie.
I was driving over to the town office when I saw Davy Hopewell running down the middle of the street.
Points toward Davy.
He said Martha Clarendon was dead, murdered. I didn't believe him, but it's true. She's... awful.
Mike, you said the person who did it was still inside. Robbie.
He spoke to me.
Hatch. And said what? Robbie. Nervous. Lying.
Told me to get out. I think he said for me to get out or he'd kill me too. I don't know. And this hardly seems like the right time for an interrogation.
Mike. What did he look like? Robbie starts to reply, then stops, puzzled. Robbie.
I barely got a look at him.
He got a pretty good one, actually, but he doesn't remember. Mike, to Hatch.
Stay on my right. Keep the barrel of that scattergun pointed down, and keep the safety on unless I tell you to take it off.
To Robbie. You, stay exactly where you are, please.
Robbie.
You're the constable.
He watches Mike and Hatch start for the gate, then calls.
Robbie.
The TV's on. Tuned quite loud. If the guy starts moving around, I'm not sure you'll hear him.
Mike nods, then goes through the gate with Hatch on his right. The townspeople have crept closer yet. We now see them in the background. The snow swirls around them in the high wind. It's still light, but thickening up. 77. Exterior, Mike and Hatch from the porch. They come up the walk, Mike tuned tightly, but in control, Hatch scared, but trying not to show it. Hatch.
Even if there was a guy, he's probably gone out the back by now, don't you think? She ain't got but a 5-foot garden fence.
Mike shakes his head to indicate he doesn't know, then taps his lips with a forefinger, indicating that Hatch should keep quiet. They stop at the foot of the steps. Mike pulls gloves out of his coat pockets and puts them on. He also takes out his own pistol. He indicates for Hatch to put on gloves, and Hatch hands him the shotgun so he can comply. Mike takes the opportunity to double-check the safety, still on, then hands it back. They go up the steps and examine the walker. Then they cross the porch. They see the feet, clad in their old lady shoes, poking out from the shadows of the hallway and exchange a dismayed glance. They go in. 78. Interior. The hall of Martha's house. Behind them, the weather lady runs on endlessly. Weather lady. Voice.
Conditions along the New England coast are expected to worsen dramatically towards sunset. Not that our down east friends are going to see the sun go down tonight, I'm afraid. We are expecting gale force winds along the Massachusetts and New Hampshire coasts, and hurricane force wind gusts along the Maine coast and offshore islands. There's going to be significant beach erosion, and once the snow starts to fall, amounts will increase dramatically until, well, until it's over. At this point, it is literally impossible to talk about accumulations. Let's just say the total fall is going to be enormous. 3 feet? That's probable. 5 feet? Even that is possible. You'll want to stay tuned for updates, and be assured we'll break into our programming if conditions warrant doing so.
The two men ignore her. They have more immediate problems. They kneel on either side of the dead woman. Mike Anderson is grim, shocked, but holding it in, already focusing on the job at hand and the ramifications to follow. Hatch, on the other hand, is close to losing it. He looks up at Mike, face pale, eyes full of tears. He speaks in a bare whisper. Hatch.
Mike.
Oh, my God, Mike. She got no face left. She... Mike reaches out and puts a gloved finger across Hatch's lips. He inclines his head toward the sound of the babbling TV. Someone might be listening. Mike leans toward his shaking deputy over the body of the dead woman. Mike, very low. Are you going to be all right? Because if you're not, I want you to hand me the 12-gauge and go back to Robbie. Hatch, low.
I'm all right.
Mike, sure? Hatch nods. Mike considers him, then decides to believe him. He gets to his feet. Hatch does the same, then sways a little. He puts a hand on the wall to catch his balance and smears some of that fine blood spatter. He looks at his gloved hand with amazement and dismay. Mike points up the hall to the living room door and the sound of the TV. Hatch gathers his courage and nods. Very slowly, the two men slip up the hallway. all played for maximum suspense, of course. They are three-quarters of the way up the hall when the sound of the TV abruptly cuts off. Hatch's shoulder brushes one of the pictures on the wall and knocks it off. Mike catches it before it can clatter to the floor, mostly by good luck and fast reflexes. He and Hatch exchange a strained glance, then go on. 79. Interior. The doorway between hall and living room. The two men come into the doorway, looking at them from the living room as we are. Hatch is on the left and Mike on the right. They look at 80. Interior. The living room, from Mike and Hatch's point of view. We see the blown-out TV and Martha's wing chair. Over the top of the chair, we see the top of Linoja's head, very still. It's probably a man's head, but it's impossible to tell if the guy is alive. 81. Interior. Resume hall doorway with Mike and Hatch. They exchange a glance, and Mike nods them forward. Camera follows as they move in on the back of the chair, very slowly. Three steps into the room, Mike gestures for Hatch to move out wider. Hatch does so. Mike moves in a step closer to the chair. We can see it now as well as the men. Then stops as a blood-stained hand appears. It goes to the table beside the chair and takes a cookie. Mike levels his gun. Freeze. The hand does just that. Freezes in midair, holding the cookie. Mike, raise your hands. Both hands up over the chair. I want to see them clear as day. There are two guns pointed at you, and one of them's a scatter. Linoge raises his hands. He's still holding the cookie in his left one. Mike indicates that Hatch should circle the chair to the front on his side. As Hatch does, Mike circles around on the right. 82. Interior. Martha's living room, angle on the chair. Linoge sits there, hands raised, face composed. There's no sign of a weapon, but the men react to his blood-stained face and coat. Linoge's calm demeanor is in sharp contrast to Mike and Hatch, who are wound as tight as guitar strings. Maybe we see here how suspects are sometimes shot by accident. Mike, hands together. Linoge puts his hands together, wrist to wrist and back to back. 83. Omit. 84. Exterior, in front of Martha's house. Several townsfolk hurry forward as far as the trunk of Robbie's car. One is an older woman named Roberta Coyne. Roberta Coyne. What's happened to Martha? Robbie, shrill, near hysteria. Just stay back. This is under control. He points his pistol at the house again, and I think we have a real question about what may happen when and if Mike and Hatch bring their prisoner out. Robbie is on a hair trigger. 85. Interior. The living room of Martha's house. Extreme close-up. Cuffs. Mike. Voice. If he moves, shoot him. Camera draws back to include Linoge, Mike, Hatch. Linoge. Low. Pleasant. And composed. If he shoots, he'll get us both. That thing's still loaded with buckshot. Both men react to this, not because it's true, but because it could be true. Hell, Hatch might blow a hole through Mike in any case. The two men are quite close together. Linoge. Also, he's still got the safety on. Hatch reacts with terrified realization. He has forgotten to take off the safety, while Mike inexpertly fumbles the cuffs onto Linoge's wrists. Hatch fumbles the safety off. As he does, the gun leaves the vicinity of Linoge completely. We need to see that Linoge could take these two courageous but fumbling locals anytime he wants, but chooses not to do so. The cuffs are on. Mike steps back, very relieved. He and Hatch exchange a rather wild look. Linoge. But you remembered to wear gloves. That was good. He begins to eat the cookie, oblivious of his blood-streaked hand. Mike, on your feet. Linoge finishes the last bite of cookie and gets obediently to his feet. 86. Exterior, Martha Clarendon's porch. Beyond it, the snow is now coming hard, with the wind driving it into slanting lines. The houses on the far side of the street are misty, as if seen through a veil. Mike and Linoge come out side by side, Linoge with his hands cuffed at belt level, a look all of us are familiar with from the evening news. Hatch is walking behind them, with the shotgun at port arms. In the street, there are now about a dozen people clustered by the rear bumper of Robbie's Lincoln. When the men come out, Robbie crouches a little, and Mike sees the man's little glove compartment gun pointed at them. Mike, put that down. Looking slightly ashamed, Robbie does. Mike, Hatch, close the door. Hatch, is that wise? I mean, aren't we supposed to leave stuff pretty much like it is? It being a crime scene and all. Mike, we leave the door open and the crime scene's going to be under 6 feet of fresh powder. Now close the door. Hatch tries. One of Martha's shoes is in the way. He squats. Grimacing, he moves her foot with one gloved hand. Then he gets up and closes the door. He looks at Mike, who nods. Mike, what's your name, mister? Linoge looks at him. There's a beat when we're not sure he's going to answer. Then, Linoge. Andre Linoge. Mike, well, come on, Andre Linoge. Let's get walking. 87. Exterior. Linoge. Close up. For just a moment, Linoge's eyes change. They swirl with black, the blue irises and the whites disappearing. Then everything goes back to normal. 88. Exterior. Resume porch with Mike, Hatch, and Linoge. Mike blinks at the sight like a man trying to cope with a momentary attack of vertigo. Hatch hasn't seen it, but Mike has. Linoge smiles at him as if to say, our little secret. Then we see Mike's rationality reasserting itself, and he gives Linoge a poke. Mike, come on, move. They go down the steps. 89. Exterior, on the concrete path. The storm blows snow past them, smacking their faces, making them wince. Hatch's hat blows off. As he looks helplessly after it, Linoge gives Mike that look again, the one that says they have a secret. Mike is less able to shake it off this time, but he gets Linoge moving. Fade out. This ends Act 3. Act 4. 90. Exterior. The little tall lighthouse. Late day. The snow flies past it so thickly we can only make out its shape, and of course its light, each time it swings around. The waves crash high on the rocks of this promontory. The wind shrieks. 91. Exterior. Godso Fish and Lobster. Late day. This long building, part warehouse, part retail fish market, is far out on the dock. Waves smash into the dock, and foam splatters high, wetting the sides and roof of the building. As we watch, the wind tears a door free of its latch. It begins to bang back and forth. Nearby, a tarp blows free of the boat it's covering and whirls off into the snowy day. 92. Exterior. The Anderson House. Late day. A four-wheel drive is parked at the curb by the Wee Folks sign. Its windshield wipers are clapping back and forth rapidly, but the glass is still snowing up. Its headlights cut twin cones through the snow-choked air. The Wee Folks sign swings back and forth on its chain. On the porch, Molly Anderson is handing over a bundled-up Buster Carver and an equally bundled-up Pippa Hatcher to their moms, Angela and Melinda. The camera moves in on the porch. All three women have to shout in order to be heard over the howling wind. Melinda.
Pip, you sure you're all right?
Pippa.
Yes. Don Beals hurt my feelings, but they're better now.
Molly.
I'm sorry I had to call you early, guys.
Angela Carver.
It's okay. The radio says they're going to keep the bigger kids over in Machias at least tonight. The reach is too choppy to send them back on the water bus.
Molly.
Probably for the best.
Buster.
Mommy, I'm cold.
Angela Carver.
Course you are, but you'll be warm in the car, honey.
To Molly.
Are there more?
Molly.
Buster and Pippa are the last.
to Pippa.
You had an adventure, didn't you?
Pippa.
Yes, Mama. I've got a smaller button.
She honks her own nose. Neither Melinda nor Angela understand, but they laugh. It's cute. They understand that much. Angela Carver.
We'll see you Monday if the roads are open. Wave a bye, Buster.
Buster obediently waves a bye. Molly waves one back as the mothers carry their babies down the steps and into the increasing fury of the storm. Then she goes back inside. 93. Interior. The Anderson House front hall with Molly and Ralphie. There's a mirror about halfway down by the telephone table. Ralphie has pulled a chair over and is standing on it so he can look at the red mark on the bridge of his nose. It's a birthmark, but actually more cute than disfiguring. Molly hardly notices him. She's relieved to be in out of the storm, and even more relieved that her little charges have all been packed home for the day. She shakes the snow out of her hair, then takes off her parka and hangs it up. She looks at the stairs, winces at the memory of Pippa's misadventure, then snorts laughter. Molly, to herself, the smaller button. Ralphie, still looking in the mirror.
Mommy, why do I have to have this?
Molly goes to him, plants her chin on his shoulder, and looks at him in the mirror. They make a rather lovely mother and son portrait that way. She reaches around and touches the little red mark on his nose with love. Molly,
your daddy calls it a fairy saddle. He says it means you were born lucky.
Ralphie,
Donnie Beals says it's a pimple.
Molly, Donnie Beals is a nut. She grimaces briefly. Nut isn't the word she'd probably use if given a free choice. Ralphie,
I don't like it, even if it is a fairy saddle.
Molly,
myself, I love it. But if you still feel the same way when you're older, we'll take you to Bangor and have it removed. They can do that now, okay?
Ralphie,
how much older do I have to be?
Molly,
10. How's that?
Ralphie,
too long to wait. 10's old.
The phone rings. Molly picks it up. Molly,
hello?
94. Interior. The market with Cat Withers.
She's on the phone behind the counter. Tess Marchant is running the checkout operation by herself for the time being.
There's still quite a line, although with the storm now on the rise, it's thinned a bit. Those people that are left buzz excitedly about the police call to the Clarendon house.
Cat. There you are. I've been trying to get you for almost 10 minutes.
95. Interior. The Anderson Hall with Molly and Ralphie. Through the rest of this conversation, the director will cut back and forth as he/she chooses. But we should see Molly almost unconsciously censoring her end, not asking all the questions she'd like to ask, because little pitchers have big ears. Molly.
I've mostly been out on the porch, handing kids over to their parents. I sent them home early. What's up, Katrina?
Cat.
Well, I don't want you to be scared or anything, but we got word that there's been a murder on the island. Old Martha Clarendon. Mike and Hatch have gone over there.
Molly.
What? Are you sure?
Cat.
I'm not sure of anything right now. This place has been a madhouse all day. Except that they went over there and Mike asked me to call you and say everything's under control.
Molly.
Is it?
Cat.
How do I know? Yeah, probably. Anyway, he wanted me to call before anyone else did it. If you see Melinda Hatcher...
Molly.
She just left here with Angie Carver. They're carpooling. You can get her at home in 15 minutes or so.
Outside, the wind rises in a shriek. Molly looks toward the sound.
Molly. Better give her 20.
Cat.
Okay.
Molly.
There's no chance it's a... I don't know... A joke? A prank?
Cat.
Robbie Beals called it in. He doesn't do humor, you know?
Molly.
Yeah, I know.
Cat.
He said that the person who did it might still be there. I don't know if Mike would want me to tell you that or not,
but I thought you had a right to know.
Molly closes her eyes for a moment, as if in pain. Probably she is in pain. Cat.
Molly?
Molly.
I'm coming down to the store. If Mike gets there before I do, tell him to stay put.
Cat.
I'm not sure he'd want...
Molly.
Thanks, Cat.
She hangs up before Cat can say any more. She turns to Ralphie, who is still examining his birthmark in the mirror. He's so close to the glass that his eyes are rather charmingly crossed. She gives him a big smile that only a 4-year-old could believe in. Her eyes are clouded with worry. Molly.
Let's go down to the store and see your daddy, big boy. What do you say?
Ralphie.
Daddy, yay!
He jumps down from his chair, then pauses, looking at her dubiously. Ralphie.
What about the storm? We've only got the car. It slides around in the snow.
Molly grabs his coat off the tree by the door and starts getting him into it at super speed. That big, false smile never leaves her face. Molly.
Hey, it's only a quarter of a mile, and we'll come back with Daddy in the truck, because I bet he's going to close the market early. How's that?
Sound good? Ralphie.
Yeah, excellent.
She zips his jacket up. As she does, we see she is terribly worried. 96. Exterior, in front of Martha Clarendon's house.
The storm is still getting worse by degrees. People are now having some trouble standing their ground against the wind-driven snow, but no one is left.
Robbie Beals has joined Mike and Hatch. His gun is still in his hand, but with the prisoner cuffed, he looks a little more at ease and has pointed the little pistol at the ground. Mike has opened the back of the Island Services vehicle. It has been outfitted to transport stray and sick animals. The floor is bare steel. There's a mesh barrier between this storage compartment and the back seat.
Mounted on the wall is a plastic water reservoir with a tube.
Hatch. You going to put him in there? Mike. Unless you want to sit in the back seat with him and babysit. Hatch. Takes the point. Get in. Linoge doesn't, at least not immediately. He looks around at Robbie instead. Robbie doesn't care for that. Linoge. Remember what I said, Robbie. Hell is repetition. He smiles at Robbie, a private smile, like the one he gave Mike. Then he gets into the back of the Island Services vehicle. Robbie, nervous.
He talks a lot of nonsense. I think he's crazy.
Linoge has to sit with his legs crossed and his head ducked, but this doesn't really seem to put him out in the least. He is still smiling, his handcuffed hands clasped in his lap as Mike swings the doors shut. Mike,
how does he know your name? Did you tell him?
Robbie drops his eyes.
I don't know. All I do know is that no sane person would want to kill Martha Clarendon. I'll come down to the store with you. Help you clear this up. We'll have to get in touch with the state police.
Mike. Robbie, I know this goes against your grain, but you have to let me handle this. Robbie bristles.
I'm the town manager here, in case you forgot. I have a responsibility.
Mike. So do I, and our responsibilities are clearly divided in the town charter. Right now, Ursula needs you over at the town hall a lot more than I need you at the constables. Come on, Hatch. Mike turns away from the furious town manager. Robbie.
Listen here.
He starts to chase them up beside the Island Services vehicle, then realizes he's being undignified in front of a dozen of his constituents. Mrs. Kingsbury stands nearby with her arm around the shoulders of a frightened-looking Davy Hopewell. Behind them, Roberta Coyne and her husband Dick look at Robbie with poker faces that can't quite mask their contempt. Robbie stops chasing Mike. He sticks his gun in his topcoat pocket. Robbie, still furious.
You're getting too big for your britches, Anderson.
Mike takes no notice. He opens the driver's side of the Island Services vehicle. Robbie, seeing them about to make their getaway, fires the only other arrow in his quiver. Robbie.
And get the sign off that damn dummy on your porch. It's not funny.
Mrs. Kingsbury puts a hand over her mouth to hide a snicker. Robbie doesn't see.
Probably lucky for her. The island services vehicle starts up and its lights come on. It heads upstreet, bound for the market and the constable's office contained therein. Robbie stands, slump-shouldered and fuming, then looks around at the cluster of people in the snowy street. Robbie.
What are you standing here for? Go on home. Show's over.
He stalks back to his Lincoln. 97. Exterior, Lower Main Street, in the snow. Headlights appear in the screaming white, and the car eventually materializes behind them. It's small, light, and two-wheel drive. It's going slow and slipping back and forth. Already there are at least 4 inches of fresh snow on the road. 98. Interior. The car with Molly and Ralphie. Up ahead, we see lights looming out of the snow on the left, plus the long porch on the hanging lobster traps. Ralphie.
It's the store! Yay!
Molly.
Yay is right.
She turns into the parking area in front. Now that she's here, Molly realizes that coming out was dangerous, but who could have guessed the snow would pile up so fast? She turns off the engine and allows herself a small slump over the wheel. Ralphie.
Mom? You okay?
Molly.
Fine.
Ralphie.
Get me out of my car seat, Kay. I want to see Daddy.
Molly.
You bet.
She opens her door. 99. Exterior. The island services vehicle. It turns left at the blinker and heads toward the market through the thickening snow. 100. Interior. The island services vehicle with Mike and Hatch. Hatch.
What are we going to do with him, Mike?
Mike. Sotto voce.
Keep your voice down.
Hatch looks guilty.
We'll have to call the state police barracks in Machias.
Bobby was right about that much. But what are the chances they'll be able to take him off our hands in this? Hatch looks doubtfully out the window at the pelting snow. This situation keeps complicating itself, and Hatch isn't a very complicated guy. They continue to talk in low voices so Linoge won't overhear. Mike.
Robbie said the TV was on, and I heard it when we were in the hall. Did you?
Hatch.
At first, yeah. The weather. Then the guy must have...
He trails away, remembering.
Hatch. It was busted. Busted all the hell and gone. He didn't do it while we were in the hall, either. You bust a TV picture tube, it makes a noise, like, boof. We would have heard.
Mike nods.
It must have been the radio.
It's almost a question. Mike doesn't reply. Both of them know it wasn't the radio. 101. Interior. Linoge in the animal transport compartment. Smiling. We just see the tips of the fangs in his mouth. Linoge knows what they know, and in spite of their low tones, he hears them. 102. Exterior. Angle on the market in the snow. Afternoon. The Island Services four-wheel drive rolls past the parking lot in the snow. The little car Molly and Ralphie came in is already wearing a fresh coat and then pulls into an alley that runs down the side of the store and around to the back. 103. Exterior. The alley from the far end. The Island Services vehicle comes toiling toward us out of the snow, headlights glaring. The camera pulls back as it reaches the snowy yard at the rear. There is a loading dock at the back of the market with a sign that says, Deliveries Only. Go through market for constable business. The vehicle pulls up here, backing into place. For this sort of deal, the dock is mighty convenient, and Mike and Hatch do have a delivery to make. They get out and walk around to the back. Hatch is as nervous as before, but Mike has got his own nerves under control as they reach the rear of the vehicle. Mike.
Safety off?
Hatch looks first surprised, then guilty. He pushes the shotgun's safety off. Mike, who has his own gun in his hand, nods in satisfaction. Mike.
You're up top.
There are stairs at one end of the loading dock. Hatch climbs them and stands with his shotgun at port arms. Mike unlocks the back doors of the vehicle, then stands back. Mike.
step out on the dock. Don't approach my partner. Sounding like a guy on Adam 12 makes Mike uncomfortable, but under the circumstances, partner is the right word. Linoge steps out, still awkwardly bent over but graceful, and still smiling that faint corners-of-the-mouth smile. Hatch takes a step back to give him room as Linoge mounts the steps. Their prisoner is cuffed, and they have the guns, but Hatch is still scared of Linoge. Linoge stands in the driving snow as comfortable as a man in his own living room. Mike climbs the stairs to the loading dock, searching in his pants pocket. He brings out a ring of keys, separates out the one that opens the back door, and gives it to Hatch. Mike keeps his pistol pointed slightly down, but in Linoge's direction. 104. Exterior. Hatch at the loading door. He bends and slides the key into the lock. 105. Exterior. Linoge close up. He's watching Hatch very closely, and now we see a flicker of blackness in his eyes. 106. Exterior. Mike, close up. He frowns. Did he see something? It was too quick to tell. 107. Exterior. The loading dock door. Close up. Hatch twists the key. Sound. A snap. And now Hatch's hand is holding nothing but the head of the key. 108. Exterior. Resume loading dock. Hatch. Aw, sugar. Snapped right off. Must have been the cold. He begins to hammer on the door with a gloved fist. 109. Interior, the island constable's office. This was once part of the market's storage area. Now it boasts a desk, a few filing cabinets, a fax, a CB radio, and a bulletin board on the wall. There is also a jail cell in the corner. The cell looks sturdy enough, but homemade, a kind of do-it-yourself project. It's a strictly temporary facility for weekend drunks and part-time hellraisers. Sound. Hammering on the door. Hatch. Voiceover. Hey! Anybody in there? Anybody? 110. Exterior. Resume loading dock. Mike. Forget it. Go around and open it from the inside. Hatch. You want me to leave you out here alone with him? Mike. Stress breaking through. Unless you happen to see Lois or Superman hanging around in the alley. Hatch. We could take him. Mike. Through the market, with half the island doing their storm shopping? I don't think so. Go on now. Hatch gives him a doubtful look, then starts back down the stairs. 111. Exterior, in front of the market. In snow that's thicker than ever, Robbie Beals' Lincoln comes spinning and slewing into the parking area, almost broadsiding Molly's little car. Robbie gets out and goes up the porch steps just as Peter Godso comes out of the market. Peter is a ruggedly handsome man in his early 40s, father of Sally, the little girl with the jam on her shirt. Peter Godso. What happened, Beals? Is Martha really dead? Robbie. She's dead, all right. Robbie sees the mannequin with the sign around its neck, genuine Robbie Beals brand lobster and gear, and yanks the sign off with a snarl. He scowls at it. Hatch has slogged around from the back just in time to see and react to this. Peter Godso follows Robbie back inside to monitor developments. Hatch follows them both. 112. Interior. The market. Afternoon. Lots of people milling around. Prominent among them is Molly Anderson talking to Kat, but mostly worrying about Mike. We see Ralphie halfway down one of the aisles and mooning over the sugary cereals. Molly, as Hatch enters.
Where's Mike? Is he all right?
Hatch. Fine. Out back with the prisoner. I just have to let him in. Other people move in on him. Peter Godso.
Is he a local?
Hatch. I never saw him before in my life. Lots of relief at this. Others try to grab Hatch's attention and ask questions, but Molly isn't among them. The sooner Hatch does his job, the sooner she'll have her husband back. Hatch fights his way up the center aisle, pausing to ruffle Ralphie's hair. Ralphie gives him an affectionate grin. Robbie still has the sign, is tapping it angrily against his thigh. Molly sees it and winces a little. 113. Exterior, on the loading dock, with Mike and Linoge. They stand facing each other in the driving snow. There are several beats of silence. Then, Linoge.
Give me what I want, and I'll go away.
Mike. What is it you want? That smile shakes Mike in spite of himself. 114. Interior, the constable's office with Hatch. He comes bustling in and hurries to the loading door. He turns the deadbolt knob and tries to open it. The door still won't open. He pushes hard, then harder. No luck. As a last resort, he slams his shoulder against the door. Nothing. The door might as well be dipped in concrete. Hatch. Mike? Mike, voiceover. Come on, hurry up. It's freezing out here. Hatch.
It won't open. It's stuck.
115. Exterior, resume loading dock with Mike and Linoge. Mike is totally exasperated. Everything has gone wrong with this piece of work. It's a complete Russian fire drill. Linoge is still smiling his faint little smile. For him, everything's right on track. Mike, did you unlock it? Hatch, rather hurt by this.
Of course I did, Mike.
Mike,
then wail on it. There's probably ice in the jam.
116. Interior. Resume constable's office with Hatch. Robbie is standing in the door behind Hatch, observing all this with heavy contempt. Hatch rolls his eyes, knowing perfectly well the door isn't frozen. He already wailed on it. Nevertheless, he hits the door another couple of good shots. Robbie crosses the room, stopping on the way to drop the joke sign on Mike's constable's desk. Hatch turns toward him, startled. Robbie, who is a physically bigger man, moves Hatch aside, none too gently. Robbie.
Let me.
He hits the door several more good shots, his look of confidence gradually subsiding. Hatch watches with subtle but understandable satisfaction. Robbie gives up, rubbing his shoulder. Robbie.
Anderson, you'll have to come around and take him through the store.
117. Exterior. Resume loading dock with Mike and Linoge. Mike rolls his eyes in annoyance. Beals in the constable's office, still meddling. Oh, goody. Better and better. Mike.
Hatch.
Hatch, voiceover.
Yeah.
Mike.
Come around.
Pointedly.
Alone.
Hatch, voiceover.
Right there.
Mike turns his attention back to Linoge.
Mike.
Be a little bit longer. Just stand quiet. Linoge.
Remember what I said, Mr. Anderson, and when the time comes, we'll talk.
He smiles. 118. Exterior, Main Street, Little Tall Island, late afternoon. The houses and storefronts are graying out, starting to look like mirages as the storm intensifies. 119. Exterior, Breakwater and Lighthouse. Huge waves crash the rocks. Foam leaps into the air. On this image, we fade to black. This ends Act 4. Act 5. 120. Exterior, the island market, late afternoon. In worsening conditions that now make moving a serious problem, Mike, Hatch, and Linoge come out of the alley and struggle toward the steps of the market. Linoge has been made to walk in front of them, and now he looks upward, smiling. 121. Exterior. Island Market's roof. Here is a little nest of radio antennas that serve the various two ways inside the store. The tallest of these radio antennas snaps off and goes rolling down the back slant of the roof. 122. Exterior. Foot of the market steps, with Mike, Hatch, Linoge. Hatch, with a flinch.
What was that?
Mike. Antenna, I think. Never mind now. Go on. Hatch heads up the steps, giving Linoge a healthy berth. 123. Exterior, the town hall. Sound. That same twanging snap. 124. Interior. Town office with Ursula. She's at her radio, which is on a table below the storm emergency take shelter poster. From the radio comes the loud sound of static. Ursula.
Come back. Rodney, are you there? Come back, Rodney.
Nothing. After another moment or two of twiddling, Ursula racks the mic and looks at the useless radio with disgust. 125. Interior. The market. Hatch, coated with snow, steps in. The shoppers react to the shotgun. Before, it was under his arm and pointed at the floor. Now, he's holding it up against his shoulder and pointed at the ceiling, like Steve McQueen in Wanted Dead or Alive. Hatch looks around at the shoppers. Hatch.
Mike wants all you folks to move back on both sides, okay? No one in aisle two. We've got us a bad guy, and we can't use the back door to bring him in like we'd like to, so just move back. Give us some room.
Peter Godso.
Why'd he kill her?
Hatch. Just move back, Pete, okay? Mike's standing out in the snow, and his feet must be pretty cold by now.
Also, we're all going to feel better when this guy's locked up. Move back, folks. Give him a clear way up that second aisle.
The customers move aside in two groups, leaving the center of the market clear. Peter Godso and Robbie Beals are with one group, the one on the left, as you look toward the back of the market. Molly is in the other, standing with Kat and Tess Marchant, who has moved away from the cash register. Hatch surveys this and decides it'll do. It'll have to. He goes to the door and opens it. He beckons. 126. Exterior, the porch with Mike and Linoge. Linoge walks ahead, cupped hands at his waist. Mike is alert for anything, or so he no doubt hopes.
Mike. Not one wrong move, Mr. Linoge. You mind me now.
127. Interior. The market features Hatch. He lowers the shotgun to port arms, one hand on the barrel and the other wrapped around the trigger. Linoge. Coated with snow, eyebrows crusted white, comes in. Mike follows closely, the gun now raised and pointed at Linoge's back.
Mike, right down aisle two, nowhere else.
But Martha's killer stops for a moment and surveys the clusters of frightened islanders. Here is an enormously important moment. Linoge is like a tiger that has been let out of its cage. The trainer is there, two of them, counting Hatch. But when it comes to tigers, only bars, lots of them, strong and thick, are safe. And Linoge doesn't look like a prisoner or act like one. He stares at the residents of Little Tall with shining eyes. The residents look back at him with fear and fascination. Mike prods him with the gun.
Come on, let's go.
Linoge starts, then stops. He looks at Peter.
Linoge. Peter Godso, my favorite seafood wholesaler, standing shoulder to shoulder with my favorite politician.
Peter flinches at being addressed by name.
Mike, prodding with the gun. Come on, andale, let's just...
Manoj ignores him.
How's the fish business? Not so good, is it? Lucky you've got the marijuana business to fall back on. How many bales have you got in the back of the warehouse right now? 10... 20? 40?
Peter Godso reacts violently. The shot has gone home. Robbie Beals moves away from his friend as if afraid of catching a flu germ. And for a moment, Mike is too shocked to shut Linoge up.
Linoge, better make sure you've got it wrapped up good, Pete. There's going to be a hell of a storm surge tonight when the tide comes high.
Mike reaches out and shoves Linoge's shoulder, good and hard. Linoge stumbles forward, but keeps his balance easily. This time, it is Cat Withers that his bright eye fixes upon.
Linoge, as if greeting an old friend. Cat Withers!
She flinches as if struck. Molly puts an arm around her and looks at Linoge with fear and mistrust.
Linoge, you're looking well. But why not? It's just an in-office procedure these days. Nothing to it.
Cat. Real agony.
Mike, make him stop.
Mike pushes Linoge again, but this time Linoge won't budge. He's as firm as, well, as firm as that troublesome stuck door out back. Linoge. Went up to Derry to have it taken care of, didn't you? Don't suppose you've told your folks about it yet. Or Billy. No? My advice would be to go ahead. What's a little scrape among friends these days? Cat puts her hands to her face and begins to cry. Any number of townspeople are looking at her with shock, wonder, and horror. One looks absolutely stunned. Billy Soames, about 23, is wearing a red apron. He's Betty Soames' son, also the market's produce man and janitor. He's Cat's steady guy, and this is the first he knows of how Cat got rid of their child. Mike places the barrel of his gun against the back of Linoge's head and thumbs back the hammer. Mike, move or I'll move you. Linoge starts up the center aisle. He's not afraid of the gun to his head. He's simply finished with this bit of business. 128. Interior. By the checkout, with Molly and Cat. Cat is sobbing hysterically, and Molly has her arms around her. Tess Marchant is dividing her attention between the sobbing girl and the incredulous Billy Soames. All at once, Molly wakes up to a very important consideration. Molly.
Where's Ralphie?
129. Interior. Aisle 2, with Linoge and Mike, Hatch in background. As they approach the end of the aisle, Ralphie comes tearing around it from the other side with a box of the sweet cereal in his hands. Ralphie.
Mom? Mommy, can I have this one?
With absolutely no hesitation at all, Linoge bends, picks Ralphie up by the shoulders, and swings him around. All at once, Mike's son is between Linoge and Mike's gun. The kid's a hostage. Mike reacts first with shock and then with sickening, agonized fear.
Mike. Put him down, or...
Linoge. Smiling, almost laughing.
Or what?
130. Interior, by the counter, with Molly. She loses all interest in Cat and hurries toward the head of aisle 2 so she can see what's happening. One of the island residents, Kirk Freeman, tries to stop her. Molly.
Let me go, Kirk.
She gives a good hard yank, and he does. When she sees that Linoge has her son, she gasps loudly and her hands go to her mouth. Mike gestures her to stay where she is without ever taking his eyes from Linoge. Behind Molly, the market customers begin to gather, staring tensely at the confrontation. 131. Interior. Aisle 2 with Linoge and Ralphie. Close-up. Linoge puts his forehead to Ralphie's so the two of them can look intimately into each other's eyes. Ralphie is too young to be scared. He looks into that shining, smiling, interested tiger's gaze with a kind of breathless interest. Linoge,
I know you.
Ralphie.
You do?
Linoge,
you're Ralph Emmerich Anderson, and I know something else.
Ralphie is fascinated, unaware of Hatch racking a shell into the shotgun, unaware that the market is turned into a powder keg of which he is the fuse. He is fascinated, almost hypnotized by Linoge. Ralphie.
What?
Linoge plants a quick, light kiss on the bridge of Ralphie's nose.
Linoge, you have a fairy saddle.
Ralphie, smiling, delighted.
That's what my daddy calls it.
Linoge returns the smile.
You bet. And speaking of daddy.
He sets Ralphie down, but for a moment, he's leaning so close that Ralphie is still, in effect, his hostage. Ralphie sees the handcuffs. Ralphie.
Why are you wearing those?
Linoge.
Because I choose to. Go on. See your dad.
He turns Ralphie around and gives him a light swat on the butt. Ralphie sees his father and lights up in a smile. Before he can take more than a step or two, Mike grabs him and pulls the boy into his arms. Ralphie sees the pistol. Ralphie.
Daddy, why have you got...
Molly.
Ralphie!
She sprints for him, brushing past Hatch and knocking a bunch of canned goods to the floor. The cans roll everywhere. She pulls Ralphie out of Mike's arms and hugs him frantically. Mike, flustered and rocky, who wouldn't be, returns his focus to the faintly smiling Linoge, who has now had about 9 billion chances to get away. Ralphie.
Why's Daddy pointing a gun at that man?
Mike. Mal, get him out of here. Molly.
What are you?
Mike. Get him out of here. She flinches at the unaccustomed shout and begins to retreat with Ralphie in her arms toward the other people clustering timidly at the foot of the aisle. She steps on a can and it rolls out from under her. Before she can fall, Kirk Freeman catches and steadies her. Ralphie, looking over her shoulder at his daddy, is finally upset. Ralphie.
Don't shoot him, Daddy. He knows about the fairy saddle.
Mike, more to Linoge than Ralphie. I'm not going to shoot him. Not if he goes where he's supposed to. He looks toward the end of the aisle. Linoge smiles and nods as if to say, of course, since you insist, and starts that way, hands in front of him again. Hatch catches up to Mike. Hatch, what are we going to... Mike,
lock him up. What else?
He's terrified, ashamed, relieved. You name it, Mike is feeling it. Hatch sees enough of Mike's emotions to be abashed and retires a bit into the background as Mike shadows Linoge to the upper end of the aisle. 132. Interior. Angle on meat counter and constable's office door. As Linoge and Mike get to the head of the aisle, Linoge turns left toward the constable's office as if he knows where it is. Hatch follows after. And then, from aisle one, comes Billy Soames. He's too angry to be scared, and before Mike can stop him, he grabs Linoge and throws him against the meat counter. Billy Soames.
What do you know about Katrina? And how do you know it?
Mike has had enough. He grabs Billy by the back of his shirt and heaves him against a rack of powdered herbs and fish fixins. Billy hits it hard and goes spalling. Mike.
What are you, crazy? This guy's a killer. Stay out of his way. And stay out of mine, Billy Soames.
Linoge.
Also, clean yourself up.
We glimpse that strange, blackish wavering in his eyes again. 133. Interior. Billy. Close up. At first, he sits there where he landed, looking question marks at Linoge. Then his nose gushes blood. He feels it, reaches up to catch the flow, and looks unbelievingly at the blood on his palms. Cat runs up aisle one to where he is and kneels beside him. She wants to help him. She wants to do anything, really, that will take away the awful look of surprise and hurt anger on his face. But Billy is having none of it. He shoves her back.
Billy Soames. Leave me alone.
He lurches to his feet. 134. Interior. By the meat counter. Wider.
Linoge. Before he gets too self-righteous, Katrina, ask him how well he knows Jenna Freeman.
Billy flinches. Stunned. 135. Interior. Kirk Freeman. In aisle two. Kirk Freeman.
What do you know about my sister?
136. Interior, resume, meat counter. Linoge.
That horses aren't all she enjoys riding when the weather's hot. Right, Billy?
Cat looks at Billy, stricken. He wipes at his bleeding nose with the back of his hand and looks anywhere but at her. His self-righteous, wounded anger has dissolved into a kind of slinking furtiveness. His face says, let me out of here. Mike. Still looks like he can't believe how screwed up this whole thing has gotten. Mike.
Move away from this man, Cat. You too, Billy.
She doesn't move. Perhaps doesn't hear. There are tears on her cheeks. Hatch uses one hand to push her gently away from the door marked Constable's office. He inadvertently pushes her in Billy's direction, and they both shrink back.
Hatch.
Kindly.
Got to get out of his grabbing range, darling.
This time she goes blundering past Billy, who makes no move to stop her, toward the front of the store. Mike, meanwhile, steps forward and picks a package of plastic bags, the kind you use to save leftovers, off a display. Then he puts the muzzle of his gun between Linoge's shoulder blades.
Mike. Come on.
Move. 137. Interior. The constable's office. The wind is very loud, scary, shrieking like a train whistle. We can hear shingles clapping and boards creaking. The door opens. Linoge comes in, followed by Mike and Hatch. Linoge moves toward the cell, then stops as a particularly hard gust of wind strikes the building and makes it shudder. Snow puffs in under the loading dock door. Hatch.
I don't like the sound of that.
Mike.
Move, Mr. Linoge.
As they pass the desk, Mike puts down the box of plastic bags and picks up a large combination padlock. From his pocket, he takes his key ring, looking ruefully at the busted-off loading door key for a second. He hands the keys and the combination lock to Hatch. He also swaps weapons, giving Hatch his pistol and taking the shotgun. As they reach the cell, Mike, put your hands up and grab a couple of bars.
Linoge does.
Now, spread your legs.
Linoge does.
Wider.
Linoge does.
I'm going to pat you down, and if you move, my good friend Alton Hatcher is going to save us all a lot of wear and tear. Hatch gulps, but points the pistol. Mike sets the shotgun aside.
Mike, don't even twitch, Mr. Linoge. You had your filthy hands on my son, so don't you so much as twitch.
Mike reaches into the pockets of Linoge's peacoat and brings out the yellow gloves. They are blotched and stained with Martha's blood. Mike grimaces with distaste and tosses them onto the desk. He rummages in the jacket pockets some more and finds nothing. He reaches into the front pockets of Linoge's jeans and pulls them inside out. They're empty. Checks the back pockets. Nothing but a few lint balls. He takes off Linoge's watch cap and looks inside it. Nothing. He tosses it on the desk with the gloves.
Mike, where's your wallet?
Nothing from Linoge.
Where's your wallet, huh?
Mike slaps Linoge twice on the shoulder. First time, sort of friendly. Second time, sort of hard. Still, no response.
Mike,
huh?
Hatch, uneasy.
Mike, take it easy.
Mike,
guy had his hands on my son. Had his face right down in my son's face. Guy kissed my son's nose. Don't tell me to take it easy.
Where's your wallet, sir?
Mike shoves Linoge hard. Linoge crashes into the bars of the cell, but keeps his high grip on the home-welded bars and his legs spread.
Mike, where's your wallet? Where's your bank card? Where's your blood donor card? Where's your discount card from Value Mart? What sewer did you crawl through to get here, huh? Answer me.
All his frustration, anger, fear, and humiliation are on the verge of coming out. He grabs Linoge by the hair and slams his face into the bars.
Mike, where's your wallet?
Hatch,
Mike.
Mike slams Linoge's face into the bars again. He'd do it again, too, but Hatch reaches out and grabs his arm.
Hatch, Mike, stop it.
Mike stops, takes a deep breath, and somehow gets hold of himself. Outside, the wind gusts, and we hear the faint sound of crashing waves.
Mike, he's breathing hard. Take off your boots.
Linoge.
I'll have to let go of the bars to do that. They lace up.
Mike kneels. He grabs the shotgun. He props the stock against the floor and plants the barrel's dead center in the seat of Linoge's jeans.
Mike. If you move, sir, you'll never have to worry about constipation again.
Hatch looks more and more scared. This is a side of Mike he's never seen, and could have done without. Mike, meanwhile, unties Linoge's boots and loosens the laces. Then he stands up, takes the shotgun, and stands back.
Mike, kick them off.
Linoge kicks them off. Mike nods to Hatch, who bends down, keeping a skittery eye on Linoge as he does, and picks them up. Hatch feels inside them, then shakes them.
Hatch, nothing.
Mike, toss them over by the desk.
Hatch does.
Mike, step into the cell, Mr. Linoge. Move slowly and keep your hands where I can see them. End of side 2.